what became a source of torment to his father in particular was that he didn't know what his son was doing in his last final minutes. And was he suffering? Was he terrified? He had this fantasy, Bobby's father, that if he'd been with him, he could have protected him, you know, which is a very paternal kind of fantasy. Anyone who loses someone, they wonder about those last minutes and they undo it. You know, they have this kind of magical thinking where they try and undo it.
That's writer Jennifer Senior talking about the family of a man named Bobby McIlvain. He died at the World Trade Center on 9/11, so 20 years ago tomorrow. In this month's issue of The Atlantic, she captures that family's grief and all the forms it's taken over the past two decades. It is a powerful and moving story, and we're going to hear it later this hour. First, though, it is Friday, and so you get to eat your dessert first. We have film reviews for you. Joining me now is Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hi, Christy.
Hello, my friend.
Hello. Also joining us is film critic Carlos Aguilar. He reviews for the LA Times and AV Club. Hi, Carlos.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you both. All right. First up, let's talk about The Card Counter. This is a new revenge thriller starring Oscar Isaac. He plays a gambler and a veteran who steps in to help a young man reckon with his past. And here's a bit from the trailer.
All in.
You count cards, right?
I'm not that smart.
But you win. You need someone to stake you.
That's what you do. You run a stable.
I'm always looking for a good thoroughbred.
Okay. That's Tiffany Haddish, the comedian, but this does not sound like much of a comedy. Christy, what's the plot?
It's also not really a thriller. It's like, it's a slow burn Paul Schrader movie, very much in the vein of First Reformed, very much in the vein of the character of Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver. Oscar Isaac is a former Abu Ghraib interrogator who has spent time in prison for what he did there. And now is going from casino to casino using the card counting skills he developed while in prison. And just kind of hiding within the depressing lighting and the anonymous casino life and doesn't really care about making money. He's just sort of like going from day to day, and yet the remorse of what he has done is slowly, steadily building up in him. Tiffany Haddish, as we heard, approaches him to stake him in the World Series of Poker. They develop a friendship and perhaps more, but Ty Sheridan also approaches him along the way about teaming up to go after the guy, played by Willem Dafoe, who trained Oscar Isaac and also trained Ty Sheridan's father to do these monstrous things to prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Oscar Isaac can't help but be great in everything, and you feel the torment and the quiet, steady boiling going on here. But Tiffany Haddish, I gotta say, I don't know how Carlos feels. I think she's really miscast here. And she's like from a whole different movie. She's not quite the bubbly, effervescent, unpredictable spark plug that we so frequently see her to be.
Carlos?
I like, you know, Oscar is a lot in this film. I don't know about Tiffany Haddish. I think I agree a little bit with Christy in terms of, like, you know, that character doesn't seem to quite fit the narrative because we're so focused on the Ty Sheridan and Oscar Isaac relationship and how magnetic he is when he's talking about the past. And so I do feel like there are things in this film that I really enjoy. I don't know if it congeals together fully, but yeah, I enjoyed it for the most part.
Okay, The Card Counter, you can see it in theaters. Up next, we have Language Lessons. It stars Natalie Morales as a Spanish teacher working to make a wealthy and bored Mark Duplass bilingual. It was filmed almost entirely on Zoom, so I'm not sure about the quality of the video there. But anyway, here's a clip from the trailer.
Who are you again?
I'm your Spanish teacher.
So I have to speak Spanish for one day.
Well, I actually bought the 100 lesson package.
Will, did you buy me 100 Spanish lessons?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you wanted to learn Spanish, dummy.
Oh.
Okay, so Carlos, this is obviously filmed during the pandemic. Everyone's on Zoom. What's the plot here?
Yeah, it was filmed during the pandemic, but the story itself doesn't take place during the pandemic. Like, it's never mentioned. The reason why these two characters are, you know, communicating through video chat is because Natalie Morales' character, Cariño, lives in Costa Rica. and you know, Adam, Mark Duplass is in Oakland. So there's a distance between them just, you know, without the pandemic. And it's very interesting, you know, to see how this relationship develops between them. The lessons were paid for by Adam's husband, who, you know, in within the first minutes of the movie dies. So this relationship becomes more, you know, about Natalie Morales is helping him mourn and sort of like go through this grieving process and sort of developing a friendship. And, you know, then it turns the other way and we get to see what's her sort of motivation and her, you know, what she's going through. I found this one very enjoyable. I thought that both of them had really interesting chemistry on screen. The fact that it's done, you know, through video chat didn't bother me. I felt like it was very dynamic, even within that sort of format. It's just very, it's comfortable in a moving way and feel good without being cloying or sentimental. I was really a big fan of this one.
Okay, Christy, this is, well, the actress is Natalie Morales, who plays Cariño, and it's also her directorial debut. She's directing this movie. What did you think?
It is. I loved it. And we've seen so many movies come out during the pandemic, just out of sheer necessity. People have had to get creative with, you know, production. And so we've seen a lot of Zoom movies. Quite frequently, they're horror movies. And this is a very different way to get into using that narrative structure, using that communication technique to tell a story. They have incredible chemistry, even through the video chats. They co-wrote the movie. It feels like a lot of it's improvised. It feels incredibly organic, but it also explores the notion that this video chat medium gives you a false sense of intimacy. It makes you feel like you really know somebody, but you perhaps don't. And I was totally charmed by it. And it's quite moving at times as well.
Well, you can see that one, ironically, not on your home screen, but in theaters only, Language Lessons. Moving on to Queen Pins, this is a comedy about suburban neighbors who wind up running a couponing scam worth around $40 million. And here's a bit from the trailer.
When you send these companies a complaint, they send you a coupon.
For free stuff. All of these free coupons come from one factory.
It's like Robin Hood. We gotta steal these coupons and sell them to families who really need them.
That's money in the bank.
Hey, dirty! Baby, I got your money, don't you worry.
Okay, Christy, this is apparently based on a true story. What is the story here?
It is a true story. So Kristen Bell and Kirby Howell-Batiste play good friends and neighbors in suburban Phoenix who come up with this coupon fraud scheme. They figure out how to get these boxes of free coupons and then they sell them online and pocket all that money. And they make millions and millions of dollars. They're clever, but they're not really criminals. And so they don't really know what they're doing. You know, I laughed here and there. It's kind of annoyingly on the nose in a lot of ways with its musical cues. There's a scene where Kristen Bell walks to the bank to deal with her ill-gotten gains, and she's wearing a blue dress, and they literally play the song Devil with a Blue Dress On. So things like that are kind of annoying. The two of them have cute chemistry together. I laughed here and there, but it's kind of forgettable.
Carlos, did you forget it already?
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of this one. There's a segment that happens in Mexico that I had a lot of problems with. That just felt sort of very trite and not, you know, interesting enough. If they're going to be using sort of Mexico as this, you know, as American movies usually do, as this sort of like lawless land where everything's terrible. There's also sort of like an interesting, you know, right wing, you know, conservative sort of vein in this film that deals with like guns and just sort of like the vibe in terms of like, you know, authority figures. And I don't know, I just feel like it was just tonally very strange. And even though there are a few laughs, you know, just because of the banter between the two main characters, I felt like it was, you know, the beats were very sort of on the nose and predictable, and you cannot know exactly where it's going. And you know, it's one of those movies that starts, you know, with the turning point, so you cannot know that this is gonna end badly, you know, for the protagonist. Yeah, not a fan of this one.
Okay, if you want, you can see Queen Pins in theaters, and if you don't want to see it in theaters, you can wait till September 30th and it'll be on Paramount Plus. Our next film is called Come From Away. It is a film version of the Broadway musical of the same name. It's set during the week following the September 11th attacks. And here is a clip.
We've got no room. With thousands of passengers arriving at any minute, the town is asking for help with, well, anything you can do.
We barely know where we are.
Just freaking out. I wish I was home.
Thank you for shopping at Walmart. Would you like to come back to my house for a shower?
Okay, well, it is the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Christy, what's going on here?
So this is a filmed version of the celebrated Broadway musical Come From Away. The small town in Newfoundland where 38 planes, 7,000 passengers had to land right after 9/11 happened because airspace over the United States got shut down. And so they came from everywhere and they instantly doubled the small town's population. This is the basis for the musical Come From Away, which would not sound like the most feel-good premise for a Broadway musical, but the songs are joyous. And for a while, they lean hard on the like folksy kind of hokey Canadian-ness of it all. There's lots of jokes about like hockey and whiskey and like moose in the road, and the accents are really thick. But what happens is these 12 players, six men and six women, portray not just the townsfolk, not just the mayor and the police officer and the lady at the coffee shop, but also passengers and flight crew and everybody you can imagine who was involved on this day. And with the movement of just a few chairs and tables, they transform a coffee shop into an air traffic control center or a plane, and they'll all move in unison in a way that is seamless and they don't miss a beat. So it's really good. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Come From Away, available today on Apple TV+. Our final film today is a documentary. It's called The Alpinist. It's about Canadian mountain climber Marc-André Leclerc and some of his most dangerous climbs. And here is a little bit from the trailer.
I just hope he's careful.
Anything can happen.
I mean, I know it's dangerous. I'm not, like, deluding myself that it's not dangerous to go soloing.
So why do it?
Okay, Carlos, well, it sounds like Free Solo Part 2. What did you think?
Yeah, so this one, you know, it tells the story of Marc-André Leclerc and, you know, a young, you know, 20-something climber from Canada who sort of didn't want the attention of the climbing world. He was doing this incredible free soloing, climbs, you know, that nobody had attempted before. And, you know, free soloing, you know, for anyone that doesn't know, means climbing these mountains without any ropes or any sort of protection. So really just very daredevil kind of stuff. And he was doing that without any cameras, without posting to social media. You know, he was just doing it for himself until, you know, there was a sort of like a post online that made him famous and people started paying attention to the climbs that he was doing. And, you know, this camera crew, these documentary filmmakers come in and they're trying to make a film about him, but he's not that interested in, you know, in being portrayed that way. He just wants to continue climbing. But I think the interesting part for me too is sort of the conversation that a lot of these people have in relation to, you know, the risk that they take and in free soloing, and is it worth it? Are these people, you know, is it reckless? And should you feel bad for people that, you know, that have died doing this, you know, when they knew that they were doing something that was really, you know, intense and sort of like risky. So that to me was a more interesting part. And of course the views, you know, when you see him climb and do, you know, these incredible feats, you know, without any support by himself, is really breathtaking. You know, the few that were actually captured when he allowed, you know, cameras around. But yeah, I feel like I saw things that probably will never see with my own eyes in this film.
Yeah. Thank God. That's all I can say. Cause Christy, Free Solo made me want to just, I couldn't even watch it, really. It was too scary even to watch it. Is this the same?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it is. It's a terrifying prospect, but because Free Solo exists and because it is so thrilling and so beautifully photographed, I think anything is going to pale by comparison. Alex Honnold is in this also for, you know, some of the talking heads, and it makes you realize how important it was for the filmmakers of Free Solo to have the access that they had to him. Because right. Marc-André Leclerc, for all of his daring, is also an elusive figure. And there are times when he does not answer the filmmakers' calls or texts for like months. And he didn't even have a phone until they gave him one. And so there's something kind of noble about the fact that he doesn't want to be photographed. He doesn't want to be followed. He does it for himself and for his own joy. And he talks about growing up with ADHD and how this is the only thing that he can really focus on. Like, he's really clear and really purposeful when he's doing this. And that's really noble, but the fact that he doesn't want people to shoot him doing it makes it hard to make a movie. Even when he's being interviewed, he's sort of like this like slippery, flighty, kind of buoyant figure, and you never really get a hold on who he is. And that is, I think, to the film's detriment in terms of how satisfying it is as a movie going experience. But yeah, he does incredible things that even Alex Honnold is like, this is crazy. So
gosh. Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Carlos Aguilar reviews for the LA Times and AV Club. Thank you both. Have a safe weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, speaking of the weekend, let us start it off right by rejoining KCRW if you've let your membership lapse, or becoming a new member if you haven't done that yet. It is quite a great feeling to make the plunge. 800-600-5279 or kcrw.com/join. We have lots of great thank you gifts there, lots of new swag for you to sport to show your KCRW pride. But we really do rely on you. You are the largest source of funding. The largest source of funding are our members. So don't wait for someone else to do it. Do it now at kcrw.com/join. Coming up, the story of one family who lost their young son on 9/11 20 years ago. His parents reacted in different ways.
The McElvans were processing this very different as a couple. And I did not know the two people could have such disparate approaches to grieving.
The story of one family and how 9/11 changed their lives in profound ways. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 20 years ago tomorrow, the worst terrorist attack in American history.
Yeah. This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that
a plane apparently has crashed into the tower
in New York
one of the
City.
Lost. I mean, do you know if there were many people in the building?
Oh, another one just hit.
Any kind of an effort up there yet? Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I can't see that second tower. There was a cascade
near the White House, and one can only wonder if that ended up in the Pentagon.
We just saw a live picture of what seemed to be a portion of the building falling away.
They seem to have the problem at the North Tower, Peter.
Let's look at the North Tower quickly.
Seems to be coming down.
Oh my God!
The second tower.
And later that night, President Bush addressed the nation from the Oval Office.
I've directed the full resources of our intelligence and law enforcement communities to find those responsible and to bring them to justice. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And a month later, Bush invaded Afghanistan. Well, for the families who lost loved ones on 9/11, the scars from that day never really healed, or maybe they metastasized into something even darker that evolved alongside our country becoming more divided, less trusting, and consumed by conspiracy theories, 9/11 or otherwise. Jennifer Senior joins me now. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she has just written a very powerful, moving cover story for this month's issue that profiles a family who lost their son at the World Trade Center. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, your story centers on the family of a man named Bobby McElvain, and he was 26 years old at the time, grew up in Philadelphia, graduated from Princeton, and worked in Lower Manhattan, although not at the World Trade Center. And we're going to get to that day in a minute and what he was doing. But first, just tell us more about who Bobby McElvain was.
Well, very specifically, he was my brother's roommate in college. And then for 4 years, they threw their stuff on the same bunk bed the first day of school. And that was that. They were fast friends and they stayed that way. And they lived together in Manhattan for 4 years as young adults navigating adulthood. Mm-hmm. So that's like in the most immediate sense who he was. More broadly, he was this miracle of self-invention. You know, he grew up, as you said, in the suburbs of Philadelphia, where it wasn't really expected that he'd go to an Ivy League school. His parents were teachers who lived paycheck to paycheck and didn't go to fancy colleges. They were very bright. They didn't expect their kid to go off and conquer the Ivy League and conquer New York City. He was extremely gifted athlete as well as a super scholar. And he wound up playing in this fluke of history. He wound up playing Kobe Bryant in high school.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there's something slightly Zelig-like about him. When he was at Princeton, he took a class with Toni Morrison, and she wrote his family not one but two condolence notes because she was so impressed with him as a student. And he was really passionate about African-American history. I don't know, you know, I could go on and on. I mean, he was kind of a prototype for this civilized person that never got sort of put into full production. He was just kind of this amazing kid.
Yeah. And so why did you think, okay, 20-year anniversary, I need to write about him and his family, what they've gone through?
Because, first of all, I know the McElveen family, right? So I got to sort of see at close range what other people were maybe seeing from a distance, which was how a family was processing this personal tragedy, but also this larger national tragedy. And I was struck early on by the fact that the McElveens were processing this very different as a couple. And I did not know the two people could have such disparate approaches to grieving. So that was one sort of intimate question that interested me a lot, which is like the varieties, the different ways that one can grieve. And, you know, Bobby's brother, Jeff, also grieved in a different way. I was also really interested in writing this story because something happened 20 years ago. Bobby kept all these diaries. He wanted to be a writer. He was a furious journaler. And his final diary has been this source of anguish for this family for 20 years. He wrote it. It was sitting on his desk when he died. And his almost fiance, a woman he was about to propose to, also named Jennifer, she asked if she could have it. And his father said yes, so she took it. But his mother was extremely upset by this and really wanted this diary and could not believe that her husband gave it away when it was this final chance to hear the last words of her son. You know, it was a chance to spend time in his company again. And it vanished. This former fiance took it. And it became the source of tremendous tension. And I thought, you know, it's been 20 years. Maybe I can get it back or they can see it. I had this kind of weird mission and purpose.
So the fiance, Jennifer, did not want to give it back at all or even make copies of it for the mother.
Well, this is what I found so kind of confusing at the time and what was a source of such torment to Bobby's mother. She understood that it was a deeply personal kind of artifact. It was not meant to be read by her necessarily or anyone for that matter. And when Bobby's former fiance started thumbing through it, she saw that her own name was everywhere in it and that it was largely about her. And it was not an unreasonable question to say, may I have it? What became very stressful and bewildering to an outsider was that whenever Bobby's mother would ask for it back, she would say, I understand that there's lots of personal stuff in here and that you don't want me to see what my son has written about you. But if my son is describing a tree, can you just transcribe for me the words of him describing a tree? And things got so tense between her and her son's former fiance that Jen said no. I mean, she said no. She dug in her heels. Things had reached this impasse. And it was awkward. She was living with the McElveens at the time. She couldn't bear being in her own apartment. So there were many discussions about this diary that these two women were having, because Jen was living under their roof and going to work every day from their house in suburban Philadelphia. And it got very tense, and it ended in total acrimony with Jen slamming the door and getting into her car and bursting into tears and never seeing the McElvains again.
Oh. And going on to have her life, she married again, had children, and never spoke with them?
No, not once. Not once. And had the diary and had it in her possession, sitting in her attic for a while. And, I mean, first she read it every night, all the time, but then just sitting in her attic. And it was this source of enduring mystery, especially for Helen McElvain, Bobby's mother. And she thought about it constantly. She brought it up with what she called her limping group, a group of six other moms who had also lost children, though not in 9/11, but who lived near her. And it was so so much a part of their lives, this kind of missing diary, that even stories on the 10th anniversary of September 11th, if they featured the McElvains, talked about that diary and referred to it as like the diary episode. It was a real source of tension within their marriage, even.
That's Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic. We're talking about her big cover story in this month's issue about one family's grief after losing their son on 9/11, 20 years ago, tomorrow. Let's take a short break and we'll talk some more. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with the writer Jennifer Senior, and she has just published a big piece in the September issue of The Atlantic about the family of a man named Bobby McElvain. Bobby was her brother's college roommate, and he died 20 years ago tomorrow in the 9/11 attacks. There's really a powerful moment in your story and in your reporting when you're sitting with Bob, the dad, and he pulls out a box that has Bobby's wallet in it. And you actually smell 9/11, or that's how you describe it. What did it smell like?
I mean, that World Trade Center dust was, it's its own scent, and it just whips you right back to that time if you smell it. It's just this acrid combination of, I don't know what it is. I don't know what was released into the world, you know? I mean, what a pulverized building and all the electrical and, you know, gases and raw materials of a building. I don't know what it was, but it's singular and super, like, acidic. It makes your eyes kind of burn. And I think I said you could smell it in your eyes.
What was Bobby doing at the World Trade Center? Because he didn't work there.
He did not work at the World Trade Center. This is what was so crushing, so heartbreaking. He had just changed jobs. He had just started at Merrill Lynch that July. He had spent a couple of years in New York book publishing. And then he realized that, you know, book publishing was no way to make a living if you didn't have a family fortune already beneath your toes. He went into corporate PR, and then he went to Merrill Lynch to do PR for them. And whatever he was doing was so casual, it wasn't even marked on his daily planner. As best as people could tell, he had to set up a colleague who was giving a presentation in Windows on the World. And the time of their presentation was 8:40. The conference that this person was attending started at 8 o'clock. That's when breakfast began. And the keynote was at 8:30. And Bobby, his body was recovered on the periphery of the World Trade Center. So he could not have been in Windows on the World that day, because everybody who was in Windows on the World was trapped. They were burned alive, or I don't know. I don't even think it was possible to jump. I think the windows were sealed shut. And they recovered his body. So the assumption was he went up, he got his breakfast, he set up his colleague, and he was on his way back because they recovered him at the periphery of the site. So he must have been clocked by burning debris, or, you know, turned around and, you know, when the building started to collapse. I mean, nobody knows, but that's what he was doing there, but he was clearly out of the building.
so clearly out of the building. And in a way, I don't know, does that make it worse? Because had he maybe walked faster or left 5 minutes earlier, he would have survived.
This is the tormenting, I think, counterfactual that every person does. Did he stop and get a cup of coffee at a cart? If he had walked to the left, if he'd walked to the right, if he saw that the, you know, usual path back to his office was congested with too many people, who knows? Who knows? You know, what became a source of torment to his father in particular was that he didn't know what his son was doing in his last final minutes. And was he suffering? Was he terrified? He had this fantasy, Bobby's father, that if he'd been with him, he could have protected him, you know, which is a very paternal kind of fantasy. I mean, but this, I think, is on everyone's mind. Anyone who loses someone, they wonder about those last minutes and they undo it. You know, they have this kind of magical thinking where they try and undo it.
And his father, Bob Sr., he really went full bore into trying to figure out what happened and undoing it to the point where he became a 9/11 truther, a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, I mean, here's sort of the way that evolved. He became very preoccupied with what Bobby had been doing at that moment. He was very anxious to know whether his boy had suffered. He worked up the nerve several years later to finally ask the New York City Medical Examiner for the report on his body, because at the time he had been strongly discouraged from looking at his body. And there were good reasons for that. Bobby had been almost completely decapitated. His right arm had been shorn off. It would have been very hard, I think, for a parent to see. I totally understand why he was discouraged from looking, but some part of him felt like he hadn't had proper closure, so he asked to see. And what is interesting to me is that he looked at that medical examiner's report, which I've seen too because he shared it with me, and he drew from it a very different conclusion that I think another person would have drawn. He decided, based on what he read, that Bobby could not have been running away from the building, that he had to have been inside the building and blown backwards from an explosion, and that the U.S. government had embroidered the building with explosives, and that this was the only thing that it could explain the savage injuries to Bobby's body. And you could say he was already kind of probably predisposed toward thinking along these lines because he had been following the 9/11 commission hearings, listening to Condoleezza Rice and others testify, and finding it deeply unsatisfying. He thought they were hiding something anyway. He was very anti-war. So he was probably psychologically teed up, but I was very surprised that it was the autopsy that in some ways did it for him. I looked at the autopsy and did not in any way come to that conclusion. I'm not a pathologist. But then again, neither is his father, you know.
But what could be the motive, does he think, on the part of the United States to have done this?
Well, so he has a very bespoke theory that's born of a lot of reading. It's really arcane and it goes really deep into the weeds. It's not like one that you will just immediately find after 10 or 15 seconds or even minutes or even hours maybe of Googling on the internet. Mm-hmm. Many of the theories around this are, oh, you know, if people say that there was, that the U.S. government was behind this, they often say as a pretext for going to war with Iraq, right, that we wanted an excuse. And to Bobby's father, that is just a side benefit. He believes, based on a few books that he's pointed me to, he thinks that what happened was the Americans illegally requisitioned gold from the Japanese during World War II, and we sat on it, and that we then used it to destabilize the Soviet Union in 1991, and that the FBI was busy investigating this, and that the U.S. government wanted to shut this down and didn't want anybody to know what the FBI was uncovering, and that the FBI had an office in the World Trade Center. I've never heard about an FBI office in the Twin Towers. This also seems like it would be the sort of skullduggery that would be the purview of the CIA. I am not sure why the U.S. government would want to destroy its own evidence. there are a lot of, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very, very convoluted theory in my mind.
Yeah.
It's one he's worked out.
Okay. And that gives him some kind of comfort, I guess, that there's some kind of reason behind what happened to his son.
I think that whenever anything like this happens, one's instinct is to try and make sense of the senseless. I think that's always true. I think it's interesting the way he has done it. His son, Jeff, will be the first to say that this is cheapening his father's research efforts, and that to simply say that this is how he grieves is not giving enough weight to all of the work he has done and how much he has read and all the things he has looked into.
But does Jeff believe it?
Well, that's a harder question. You know, like, Jeff is not interested in exploring this question. To him, I mean, Jeff's feeling is, like, my brother's gone. If this is what he wants to do for the rest of his life, it's fine. But I think Jeff sort of tries to sidestep that question. I think it's, or wants to show support for his father's efforts, whether he thinks that, the government orchestrated this explosion in order to conceal shenanigans having to do with our requisitioning of Japanese gold. I can't say.
And what does his wife, Helen, think of this?
I think that she, as she says, she supports the man, right? And not necessarily the arguments. I think she has said to me, I wish he'd stick with the buildings. I think she's listened to him on the phone enough and overheard enough stuff that this was a controlled demolition. I don't think that there's any truth to it. She's persuaded by it. But she's not, again, she's not an activist when it comes to this stuff. She's supporting Bob when it comes to this stuff. And she wishes that if you were going to sort of make a case for it, that she would sort of stop there, I think. But you know, again, like her son, this isn't really what she wants to be doing with her time, right? Her feeling is there are other ways she could be spending her time. And she doesn't really want to know the details of, like, what the autopsy report says. And she doesn't want to spend all of her time thinking about 9/11. She has other ways of processing her grief.
Right. And that is such an interesting part of your story, is this idea that we all process grief differently. And there's no right or wrong way necessarily. And there's no way to know how you're going to be doing that until the time comes. How does she process this, or how has she avoided processing it?
Well, that's what's interesting. So, you know, Bob Sr. leans very far into his anguish and his pain. He inhabits it. Every day for him is September 12th. He's got a mystery to solve, and he's got U.S. malfeasance and abuses of power to expose. Helen decided she didn't want to be a victim at all. She went the other direction. You know, Bob Sr. will talk to anyone and everyone about September 11th. Helen decided she didn't even want to go to the same grocery store for the first 15 years after September 11th because she didn't want people making halting, awkward, fumbling conversation, issuing condolences that she felt like she then had to, you know, kind of manage because they would be awkwardly said. She didn't want people to sit there and pity her openly. She was starving her grief. She really wanted people to just kind of believe that she was okay, you know? And I can totally understand that point of view, that it's very hard to manage other people's distress when you yourself are grieving.
You're listening to my conversation with Jennifer Sr., and we've been talking about the family of a man named Bobby McIlvaine, who died on 9/11. More of our conversation after a break. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. This hour, I've been speaking with Jennifer Sr., who has a big profile in this month's issue of The Atlantic, about how one family processed their grief after losing their son on 9/11. So, Jennifer, let's talk about this phrase, life loves on. You describe it as a family motto attributed to Bobby, but no one really knew where it came from when he said it. Just tell us more about that and why they clung to this phrase.
Yes. And oh my God, this was a source of tremendous anxiety for me from a journalism point of view because I couldn't find it. So Life Loves On is this quote that they did indeed attribute to Bobby. And it became this organizing motto for their grief. It was such a powerful motto that Helen was given an engraved bracelet with it, with this motto in it, and she wears it all the time. And Bob Sr., his father, has it tattooed on his arm. So it's serious. You know, the people in Helen's so-called limping group, some of them have it as a sign-off, life loves on. I mean, it's really a thing. So Helen first thought, oh, it's in one of Bobby's diaries from when he was young, when he was in college. And I went through them and I read them and I found nothing. And I went through all of the legal pads that he had written, like kind of aphorisms and fragments of fiction and quotes that he liked and diary entries that just hadn't made it into leather-bound volumes. And I couldn't find it there. I was going crazy trying to find out where this phrase came from. And we couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. No one could find it.
So you actually went to talk to his fiancée, Jen, who hadn't spoken with the family basically in the last 20 years. And this diary, as we discussed earlier, was a great source of conflict between Jen and Bobby's mother, Helen. So you went to her house to talk to her. And what was that like?
You know, it was really interesting seeing Jen because, of course, she had been enshrined in McIlvain family lore as this ogress, this villain, you know? And so I woke up one morning and I thought, she can't be. Like, I met her. She was lovely. There's got to be another story. And of course, the second I show up at her house, she couldn't be more gracious. She's so warm. She gives me this giant embrace. And she's got everything that Bobby, you know, that was of any significance to her that Bobby had given to her. She had, including that diary, she had it sitting in a canvas bag, ready for me to look at. So she was at that point very far from withholding. She was quite open.
Well, after that, was she okay with sharing the diary with Helen after all these
years?
Yeah,
more than okay. In fact, well, here's what I think is so interesting about that diary. First, it brought out everyone's worst self. And then it brought out everyone's best self. She was the first to admit the ways that she had kind of made mistakes when it came to handling that diary. And when Helen finally got to read it, Helen was the first to admit that she may have made some very faulty assumptions about who it belonged with and what was in it. I don't, this is an older reference, but I keep thinking of the movie The Usual Suspects, where the final scene, you're sort of staring at the bulletin board in the detective's office, and you realize that every single thing you've been thinking has been wrong. And the evidence is all sort of pointing to something entirely different. And it had a little bit of that goose-pimpling feeling to me.
Reading the diary?
Well, and just knowing that everybody suddenly, well, more that, like, I imagine that both Helen and Jen suddenly realized there were really two different sides here, and there were two very different ways to think about this question. And each of them at the time only saw one, namely, that diary should be mine.
Because it was the last piece of Bobby, and who could lay claim to that last piece and to him more completely, the mother or the fiancé?
And it was never going to be an easy question, right? I mean, not ever. And I mean, I think what is sort of fascinating to contemplate is that if Jen had been officially his fiance, and there was a ring. Helen actually gave it to her after Bobby died. It was sitting, you know, in their house in suburban Philadelphia. He'd purchased it and had it sent there. You know, so if she had been the official fiance, or if she had been married to him, if she had been the mother of his children, there would have been far less of a question, right? Like I think she would have had a very legitimate claim, but she really fell through the cracks. She was in some gray zone. She was sort of suspended in this liminal place without status. But when you actually read the diary, it's really quite astonishing because you suddenly realize why she was hanging on to it.
There is a scene that Helen describes where they're sitting on the beach, where he's in the middle of the two of them, the mom and the fiance, Helen and Jen. And can you just describe that scene? Because I think it says a lot about what we're talking about.
Yeah. So this was maybe 10 days before he died. It was Labor Day weekend. and they were on the beach in Cape May, and Helen was sitting next to Bobby, who was sitting next to his fiance Jen. So Bobby was in the middle. And it was this beautiful day, and the beach looked beautiful, and it was sunny, and there was a breeze. And Helen turned to run her fingers through Bobby's hair. She always loved his hair. He had thick, lovely hair. And at that exact moment, Bobby turned to run his fingers through Jen's hair. And Helen had this kind of epiphany. Oh my God, he's not mine. He's hers. And she just didn't know Jen that well. You know, he was up in New York. She was in suburban Philadelphia. They didn't go up and back all the time. She'd only met Jen a few times. So, you know, I don't think that she quite understood the intensity of that relationship, maybe until that moment. Or, you know, I mean, it's hard not to. Bobby was so young. He was 26. That I think the bulk of her memories were still of him as like a little boy, right? Still as a kid. And he hadn't moved into his own apartment and started a family on his own. He was still living with my brother, his college roommate. You know, he still might have seemed like a kid.
Yeah, but the way you describe him, he seems so wise beyond his years. I mean, he just seems like, as you say, a miraculous person.
He was, and I think the thing is both can be true. You can have an old soul for a child and still have a deep yearning to parent them if they're just still very, very, very young, right, when they die. I mean, that's a very hard yearning to shake. I think that's even hard for parents who have children in their 50s, you know. I think you want to, that deep desire to parent is strong.
Right. I don't think that ever ends. You say when Bobby was still alive and you were just starting out in the journalism biz and you were working for New York Magazine, and he gave you some criticism, right? I mean, here he's younger than you, but he kind of sussed out this pattern that you had of letting other people have the last word in your stories, ending with a quote. And he said, you know, if you're going to see the last word, you better be damn sure they deserve it, right? I mean, he knew that even though he wasn't a writer. He taught you that lesson.
Right. Well, and in fact, yeah, I mean, he didn't say it in those words, but he gave me endless grief about it, and he thought it was a cop-out, and he thought that it was lazy, and he thought that I wasn't asserting my own self. Yeah. And he thought it was a tick, and he was right. He identified it. And at that point, he did think of himself as a writer. He had, you know, when he died, he had two novels, two beginnings of novels, and he was far into both of them when he died. And he worked in publishing for 2 years, and he took a class with Toni Morrison. I mean, he was very interested in writing, and he read me very attentively. I was, you know, his roommate's older sister who was, you know, pursuing a path that perhaps he had not pursued. And he felt like he could, you know, with a grin, give me grief. And the crazy thing is, he was right. He was right. This is what killed me. I was 27 and thinking that I knew so, so much. And of course, I knew nothing. And, you know, he at 22, this is when, you know, I first got this job writing about theater. And at 22, he was like giving me grief, telling me that I was developing a really boring, annoying writer's tick.
Did you think about that when you were writing this article?
I thought about it so much when I was writing this article. And shrewd readers will see exactly the ways that I thought about that bit of advice.
Okay, I won't give it away because I think people really should read your article because it's really beautiful and well worth the time. And I want to thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jennifer Senior, staff writer at The Atlantic, where you can read her profile of the McIlvain family, whose son Bobby was killed in the 9/11 attacks 20 years ago tomorrow. Well, Press Play's producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Nihar Patel. Also, Brian Hardzinski, who produced that interview with Jennifer Senior. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. Sue Margulies also engineered this week. And I have a few more seconds left of the show to get you to become a member of KCRW. It's our good old-fashioned pledge drive. We do it every fall. It's very simple. You give and we play on. We continue to deliver news programming, cultural programming, music programming, all the stuff that you love on KCRW. You're going to head into the weekend and hopefully groove to some great new music and learn about some new music and maybe be inspired by some interviews like the one you just heard. It's our mission to be a public service radio station, and the public means you are in it too, and we really don't survive without you. You are our largest source of funding. So start the weekend off right. Go to kcrw.com/join. 800-600-KCRW is the telephone number. And when you go online, you can check out all of our great thank you gifts. We have a ton of them there. And you can also say no to the thank you gifts and donate instead to the Los Angeles or Santa Barbara regional food banks. And that is a great way as well to give twice to two worthy organizations. Whatever you do, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. We can't do it without you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Have a fantastic weekend. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll be with you again on Monday.